Hello and welcome once again to another episode of Lickman and Rizoff live, in air quotes, at Grassroots Tavern. I'm John Lickman, contributor of The House Next Door and Tired Zombie Whore.
I'm Vadim Rizov, recent undergraduate.
Yay! Joining us tonight is brand new House Next Door editor, Keith Rulick.
Thank you very much, Sean. Glad to be back.
And our special guest is Andrew Underberger, a pop culture blogger. And you may have seen him on VH1 a long time ago.
Yeah.
And what's the name of your...
Last summer.
Intensity's Intense Suburbs.
And we're
talking close enough here.
What? Remind us what the name of your winning team was.
We were Twisted Misters.
Yes.
Yet to be invited back for a second season, but we're not holding that against anybody.
First topic of tonight is the unfortunate letting go of Mr. Glenn Kenny from Premiere.com.
Requiem for Glenn, but I'm certain he will make it out of this. And he's already set up a new blog called Some Came Running, named after the Dean Martin film that inspired Michelle Piccoli's look in Contempt, the Godard movie. So, perfect.
So, I kind of hate to see Glenn go, but I mean, the blog was getting really interesting in the last few weeks. We had the porn star story, which was heartbreaking. Then Glenn's Glenn's testing out his camera before he went, before he thought he was going to Con.
Well, man, I don't even know if he still is going to Con. I mean, I guess not for Premiere, but I don't know. I would hope he would, because his, you know, his criticism was always something that inspired me deeply, even when I was, I remember in high school. You know, I sort of would just pick up Premiere like Entertainment Weekly or anything, you know, just because it was a movie magazine. But I always found his reviews were... And I aim on writing about this in my column on Sunday, the editorial column at The House. I just found his reviews sort of better than the magazine itself most of the time.
Well, Glenn, I mean, he overshadowed Premiere. Like, Glenn became...
Yeah.
It was more Glenn Kenny's site than it was ever Hatcher Media's. So, on that note, Vadim, can you give us your favorite Glenn moment?
I really enjoyed the annotated guide to Pierrot Lefou's references.
Indeed.
It showed a shocking level of erudition and... to a certain extent, you know, it was shocking that Premiere would bankroll that kind of thing. And Glenn also deserves credit for entertaining anyone who has even a toe in the film critic scene in New York with his exhaustive and frequently extremely entertaining vituperative attacks on people who absolutely deserved it.
Are we talking about Mr. White?
Sure, Mr. White. And
oh, yeah.
Armand. Armand, our good friend Armand, yeah.
We'll get him on the podcast someday.
Oh, I would love that. I would love that.
We're going to play Morrissey songs for him all night while he's here.
And call everybody at the table hipster, but, you know.
So, it's sad to see you go, Glenn, but we know you'll always be around, and we can't wait to see you come back.
And yeah. if you could bring David Foster Wallace with you, that would be
That was one of the premiere highlights, just a David Foster Wallace essay on Lost Highway that I think, as I recall, Glenn got him to do or something,
and
had a big hand in it.
My favorite thing written about David Lynch, and it was just fantastic.
And I just have to say for Glenn, because you asked Vadim, what his favorite piece was, and the one that sticks out in my mind, and it's probably, maybe to Glenn it's even just a toss-off, but I love his review of Code 46, especially when he deconstructs and analyzes the... that makes it sound more academic than it really reads, but, you know, analyzes the cameo by The Clash, Joe Strummer.
Mick Jones,
Of The Clash in there, saying, should I stay or should I go in karaoke? And what that all means. And I just remember that as something, you know, just really intelligent, really engaged and passionate. I also loved his love for Alan Renee, which he often showed on the blog. Especially his appreciation of, I forget the name of the movie. It's not I Know Where I'm Going. It's a Michael Powell movie. But it was like, it was something with Gerard Depardieu dressed up as Popeye at one point. And he had, that was the still image for the day. And I just remember being really, I loved that. And I also loved, you know, when Stephen Witte got on the comments section, actually, in Glenn's blog and said, you know, where else am I going to go where I can hear a mention of the Jimi Hendrix sex tape and something by Godard, I think. I'm misremembering exactly what it was, but it was like, you know, all these different things coexisted on Glenn's blog, and he never, you know, like, used one to kind of devalue the other in some way. I mean, he's one of the few critics, I think, who really, like, loves a lot of things across the spectrum, and I think it's great that his last review was, so it seems, was Speed Racer, which he saw a lot of value in, and which I absolutely agree with the value that he sees in it. So.
And I, Glenn, will miss you for your lolcat movie macro images. Because I, of course, can't read.
Yeah. So. The LOL cats are quite something.
So, moving on from Glenn, Keith and Vadim have spent the last week and a half at Tribeca.
Yes, we have.
Which is why this podcast has not been updated. I've been at home crying myself to sleep, waiting for them to call me.
I was actually curled up in bed next to John, licking his salty, salty tears.
Not his salty chocolate balls, but anyway.
You know, this is why Odie thinks we're gay.
I don't think that.
Okay, no, we should talk about this right now.
Anyway.
That's going to be cut. So, guys.
No, it isn't.
You were at Tribeca.
Yes.
What were the standouts of what I call the world's worst local film festival?
Well, you know, there were a good many, actually, for me, even though I was contracted to see a lot of not-so-good things.
How many did you see in total?
What?
How many did you see in total?
Probably about six. I mean, I didn't really go all that much, but, you know, I'm sad for one, actually, that I missed Summerstown by Shane Meadows, because I hear a lot of good things about that. What?
I have a screener for it.
Okay. Well, then I should get that screener. And also, I think it was called The Secret of the Grain.
Yes.
Was a movie that a lot of people recommended highly, highly. So I'm sad I missed that.
I didn't see that yet, but
right.
A company that shall be unnamed is going to pick it up, so don't worry about it.
Okay. Yeah. And
are they independent film?
Now,
I wouldn't want to talk about that.
Now, I will say that one of my biggest disappointments was Bill Plimpton's film, Idiots and Angels, which actually... Yeah, I wasn't all that crazy about. And
but I saw it at Comic-Con, or at least the parts that were ready at last year's Comic-Con. It looked great.
It's got all his, you know, his kind of weird sexual hang-ups and you know, other things in it, but for some reason it just didn't all come together for me. And I still have to review it for UGO, which contracted me to do that. I'm not going to, you know, when I say biggest disappointment, I don't necessarily mean that Idiots and Angels was a waste of time. Bill Plimpton is always worth engaging and such. I mean, I really like a lot of his stuff, but for whatever reason, this one just didn't quite grab me as much as some of the others. And probably when I review it, I'll have more to say about that. Then there were things like Bart Got a Room, which is this Floridian kind of prom comedy with William H. Macy as the father to this... young teen in Florida, kind of, it's kind of very conventional in a lot of ways, except it makes a great visual pun on a sandhill crane, which I know from my time down in Florida is a ubiquitous bird down there. So, you know, it has an occasional laugh or such. The worst film I saw was probably The Universe of Keith Haring, which was a pretty much terrible documentary, only because the director made it a he was born, then this happened, 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 then he died.
Lame.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Whereas a really great companion piece to that film, which was a great movie about the New York art world, was Guest to Cindy Sherman, by Paul H. O., who was the host of this cable access show, Gallery Beat, you know, made basically a movie about his show and also his relationship with the reclusive artist Cindy Sherman, who granted a lot of interviews to him when he was on Gallery Beat, and through that they fell in love. But he sort of made this movie at a start as to sort of assert himself in the shadow of Cindy, because Cindy was so overshadowing him, sort of like, as they show in the movie, Elton John overshadows his lover in a lot of ways, to the point that, like, at certain functions, you know, they're either called, you know, guest of this person and put at another table, or you know, just constantly seen in the shadow of, you know, the more famous personality. And so Paul sort of made this movie with a co-director to kind of assert himself, but as he was making the movie, his relationship with Cindy began to break down. So then it becomes this kind of self-confessional. And that could be very self-aggrandizing in a lot of ways, but he walks this very interesting fine line between self-aggrandizing and self-critical, and he never falls into one or the other so terribly that it becomes, you know, that it becomes a hideous movie. It actually is a really great movie, and anything that shows that shows someone like poking holes in Julian Schnabel is fine with me. So, you know, God bless that. My favorite movie? Headwind by Mohammad Rasalaf, which is an Iranian documentary about satellite dishes in Iran and how they are increasingly more and more popular, but how they are also opposed by the clerical government over there. And so there's this sort of push and pull between all these people, you know, all the subjects in the film who want these satellite dishes and want to know what's going on beyond the sanctioned Iranian networks and, you know, and you know, what the satellite can give them. And Rasalaf did this movie called Iron Island a few years ago that was one of my favorite Iranian films ever, which took place entirely on a freighter almost entirely on a freighter in an ocean. And this is a video documentary that, like a lot of Iranian films, sort of mixes nonfiction and fiction in the sense that it films its nonfictional subjects in a fictional kind of way.
Non-doc style? Like a fictional documentary style?
In that he follows, like, the satellite technicians on their jobs, but does it in such a way that the aesthetics show that it had to be pre-planned and or, you know, set up ahead of time. So it was like he was directing them, you know, go through your usual motions and I'm going to do, like, shot, reverse shot, long shot here, close up here. You know, it's not like just documentary aesthetic following in some way, shape, or form. It is very much intentionally fiktional in some ways, like Kiarostami did with Close Up, let's say, or something like that. And, I mean, Rasalaf has his own style that I really, really dig, and that is a film that I hope gets a release. It's only 65 minutes long, and it was paired with this wonderful Jay Rosenblatt short called Beginning Filmmaking, which is about his 4-year-old daughter getting her first camera and making a movie between the time she's 4 and 5. It has its standard kind of cuteness affect that you think from getting a 4-year-old, but he's also not afraid of showing her at her worst as well. And there are plenty of 4- and 5-year-olds, as I'm sure we all know, who can be divas. So, I think that pretty much sums up my Tribeca experience. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else, but let me throw it to you guys now.
So, Vadim, what did you mean?
I had a
shitty experience last year.
Last year, I had the pleasure of covering the less than 42 of the films at the Tribeca Film Festival.
For the Reeler, God
bless you. For the now dearly departed Reeler.
Not dearly departed, still there, it updated today.
Yes.
With a lot of those 71, like, comments from, like,
From
spam sites in Viagra, yeah.
Let's be nice.
Yes.
Last year, I discovered about 1 out of 3 movies ranges anywhere from tolerable to actually super good. Mostly on the tolerable side, saw about 16 so far. I still have a few more screeners to get through, but that ratio is about still true. The best things I saw was on the practical side, a British horror comedy called The Cottage, which Sony is foolishly putting out direct to DVD on the 13th. It is, like all British movies, has no budget whatsoever, and you can totally tell because the first half takes place basically in one room. But it's extremely funny. It stars some dude from a show called League of Ordinary Gentlemen, which I guess British comedy people know about. I don't. And Mr. Andy Serkis, aka Gollum and King Kong. And it's extremely funny, and I'm not really much of a gore hound, but it is so inventively disgusting that I have to tip my hat to it. And you should rent that, because Sony, you really fucked this up. You could have put this out. You don't have to dump it like some shitty fucking Saw ripoff. You really don't have to do that. The other movie, unhelpfully, is My Marlon Brando, a really terrific Turkish reconstruction of a woman who was in love with this Kurdish actor and traveled through Turkey to Iran to meet with him on the cusp, just as the invasion was starting. It's really good. It has no sap whatsoever. It's got the kind of documentary verb of Jafar Panahi, and it's awesome. Super most excellent. Otherwise, Summerstown is fine. I don't know why everyone is so freaked out about it. And
you weren't crazy about it?
It's fine. It's perfectly okay, but I mean,
You know, I think people are just shocked that Shane Meadows, you know, who had such a terrible reputation with a lot of people 5 years ago, now makes movies that are, you know, watchable, even praiseworthy.
So, what point do you feel Shane Meadows becomes watchable?
I did not even see anything he made because I heard such terrible things until This Is England. I heard that Dead Man's Shoes was an abomination, you know, on the
it's
face
not
of
an
the
abomination.
Lord.
No, it's an interesting. So,
someone, I trusted said he had major problems with it. And,
all right.
And I saw This Is England. I was like, hey, you made the skinhead Dazed and Confused. That's quite an achievement there.
All right.
Summerstown, perfectly cute, nice movie. I saw a lot of mediocre crap. I saw movies that are promising but extremely flawed. They have no business being in a quote-unquote major film festival.
I'm actually remembering, I saw this ESPN-bought documentary called Kicking It, which is about the Homeless World Cup. The Homeless World Cup, where basically they created a World Cup sort of soccer, which they call football, you know, as it should be, series in that took place in Cape Town, South Africa, and I think this is the sixth incarnation of it. And basically, it was to gather a lot of homeless people, leagues around the world, and have them all compete. And
homeless soccer leagues?
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's a very good documentary, save for, you know, the sort of self-satisfied Colin Farrell bookends.
Wait, where, oh my.
Yeah.
Colin Farrell?
Yeah, where Colin Farrell comes on and sort of says, if you want to learn more information, go here. I'm giving Colin Farrell more...
I love Colin Farrell.
I love Colin Farrell, but he's giving... But I'm giving... And I'm giving him more of an affect, you know, sort of like an aristocratic affect than he really has. But, yeah, but the documentary is really good because it's sort of really, it's not really about who wins the game necessarily, even though it kind of follows that structure. It's basically about the different personalities of certain nations. It follows certain people from each of the nations. Like, you know, Russia is really in it to win it. They have it that way. The USA is very, you know, hot-headed and, oh, we can do anything, rah, kind of thing. Spain doesn't give a shit. They just kind of want to be there because they want to bring people together, you know, in this league because it'll help everybody. So it's like, it's sort of a lot of different temperaments of different countries represented on in this movie, and I think it's really great.
So who are you rooting for?
You know, you don't root for anyone. That's the thing. The way it's sort of filmed, it doesn't really matter who wins. It's just more about exploring the temperaments of the country and everything. So,
weird.
You know, and so I like that one quite a bit. You know.
Well, speaking of temperaments, Andrew, you have a feature over your blog about the, was it the top film villains or top...
The 66, because that was the number I could think of. Best villains in movie history.
Wow.
That don't kill anyone. That aren't in any way admirable for their, you know, their sort of coolness. That are sort of like what I call emotional villains. Their villainy is not necessarily destructive, but it's more purely hateable than that of a Darth Vader or a HAL 9000 or, you know, any more standard AFI top villains.
But I was really shocked at the fact that you had Cher from Clueless on.
I did not have Cher. I had Amber from Clueless.
Oh, Amber. I'm sorry.
Big difference, you know.
Jesus.
Alicia Silverstone would be very upset about that.
Yeah, if anyone knew where she was in a ditch.
Yes, that's a good point.
Poor Alicia. Anyway, go on.
But so yeah, like people like Amber from Clueless is sort of you know, villains that are minorly effective, but not you know, tyrannical, I suppose, in their villainy.
Well, it's gonna seem, because you're in your, are you working from the back to the front or from the front to the back right now?
From 66 to 1.
And what are you on now? Number?
I'm on 37. Huh? All right, I'm doing 6 at a time, and I just posted 30, you know, 42 through 37.
So I mean, how do you gauge what counts for this? Are you looking at like 80s teen films only? Or are you looking at
I mostly work with, you know, like, I'd say most of them in the last 30 years or so, sort of, you know, modern era film, but, you know, characters that, I guess are thoughtless in their insensitivity mostly. And, like, this is the best example I could think of, is going to be far higher to come on the list, is Catherine Keener's character in Being John Malkovich, Maxine character, who I think is maybe the most evil character to ever be put on film.
Wow.
Her sheer recklessness and her almost insatiability in the way she utterly destroys John Cusack's life. You know, characters
which I think
like
is
that.
A pure example of Charlie Kaufman's self-pitying bullshit, but
possibly, yes. But I was wondering if the people at this table had to make that list, who do you think fits those qualifications?
Wow. So, most evil villain who's
never killed anybody,
or
never
hurt them.
You're not to hurt people, but
immediately what jumps to mind: Laura Linney in The House of Mirth. Because I hate Laura Linney in general. I think she's one of the worst actresses to ever grace the screen. I want to do this feature called like Laura Linney Looks, where you just show Laura Linney like looking around, because her looks, her basic look in a certain direction can kill. She is awful. If you've seen anyone. I don't understand anyone who praises The Savages. I don't know why that movie got so much press. I think it is one of the most god-awful movies I have seen in the longest time. I'm sorry, I'm getting off tangent. Anyway, Laura Linney in The House of Mirth, though, perfect casting, because she destroys Lily Bart. You know,
your beloved Gillian Anderson.
My beloved Gillian Anderson.
I didn't remember there was Laura Linney to play.
Yes.
Wow.
So you see, of course, there's the meta aspect to it, where it's like she's destroying Gillian Anderson, which makes me hate her even more. But there's just that scene. I don't know if you've all seen The House of Mirth.
A long time ago.
Where basically, you know, they're in Italy or off a yacht and whatever, and Lily's been staying with them on the yacht, and they're at this kind of like dinner, you know, just in the on the island. And Lily's about to return to the yacht, and then Laura Linney just gets up and she's like, "Miss Bart is not going to the yacht. Miss Bart remains here." And it's just the most. She's basically embarrassing her in that way of the Victorian era kind of. I'm not really insulting you explicitly, but I'm insulting you implicitly in ways that, if you know how to read it, will cut even deeper than if I just called you, if I just said, "Fucking bitch, you ain't coming to my fucking yacht." You know, I mean, like, you know, like that. What she, you know, she is magnificent in that role, Laura Linney. And I will give her that credit. And she, and her character's name is Bertha Dorset. And, you know, Terrence Davies directs that scene and that movie absolutely brilliantly. And, I mean, I think that is, you know, but that is, like, the quintessential scene that I remember, because it's just one of those things that makes, you know, if you're attuned to it, it makes your fucking skin crawl. And you just want to hit her, but you know in these Victorian-era movies, they never, never get their comeuppance. You know, it's just like, it's like pushing the person you're really with to suicide and or ruin and or whatever. And, you know, that is probably the most horrifying thing, I think, that I can see on a movie screen. It's just someone who is so awful that they would destroy another human being, not by murder, but by just words.
I think these are the kind of villains that actually, you know, they actually really get to audience members, because, you know, you're not going to really meet a Darth Vader type in your day-to-day life, but you might meet someone like this.
Which I think is something is different from someone like Mrs. Carmody, Marcia Gay Harden in The Mist, which is such a hootable villain that when she's finally shot, you know, it's kind
spoiler
of
spoiler alert!
Yeah,
oh, come on.
Well, fuck that.
Speaking of being shot,
yeah.
Way to go, Aaron, shooting your little kid.
Who?
Oh no, that's not Aaron Eckhart. Oh, I fucked that up.
What?
It's Thomas Jane.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Oh, Punisher?
No.
In The Mist.
Yeah, The Mist.
Oh, The Mist. Well, whatever, you know.
Come on.
I mean, The Mist, whatever about The Mist. But I was just mentioning about Mrs. Carmody, you know, the...
Yeah.
You know, well, it's kind of like... That's kind of the crudible Stephen King villain. That said, I guess you could say that in his novel, Misery, I mean, Annie Wilkes... Annie Wilkes doesn't kill anybody.
No, she does.
I'm sorry. I forgot. She kills the sheriff.
But even still, she's more of like in the horror villain template.
Yeah, she's still
she's not the emotional.
Sure. Anyway, go
but
on.
But Aaron Eckhart, he's got one of the
oh,
prime examples.
In The Company of Men. That's
very
right.
Possibly
oh,
number one example.
Awful in that. So I mean, in a way that like makes your skin crawl.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've got two examples. I'm wondering if they fit.
What's happening?
Right off the bat, John Glover from Office Space.
Who's John Glover?
He was the boss.
Oh, wait, Lumberg?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you said John Glover. I'm sorry. Yeah, Lumberg in Office Space. Yeah, the Gary Cole character. Yeah.
Oh, Gary Cole.
Gary Cole,
John
right?
Glover. Oh, sorry. Gary Cole.
Yeah, Glover. No, that's absolutely on my list. Yes. Yeah.
That's like that.
In terms of the skin crawling quality, absolutely.
Skin crawling, knowing you deal with that guy on a day-to-day basis.
No, you deal with that guy because you work in corporate.
Well, that may be, but still. I love my meetings after meetings. But then look, have you ever seen Grave of the Grave of the Fireflies?
In Japanese class once a long time ago, I don't really remember.
See,
it so
the
well.
Aunt of the children, who takes them in after their home is bombed in Tokyo, doesn't feed them, doesn't clothe them, puts them out on the street every day to work, and then doesn't care when they go away to die.
Neglectful parent characters are definitely on the list. Like I had Stanley's father in Magnolia.
Oh yeah.
The game show father, like that sort of character. That's definitely up there for me.
I never hated that guy. But what does it mean to be the neglectful parent? Like, do you only use Stanley, or who else is there?
Sorry?
For the neglectful parent, like who else? Like what else would you see other than Stanley's dad?
Other than Stanley's dad, I had a bunch. Have you ever seen? Oh, have you ever seen He Got Game?
Yes,
Spike Lee movie. Like he has, Jesus Shuttlesworth, the Ray Allen character, has this uncle who keeps on telling him, once you get to the big leagues, you gotta buy me like this car, and you gotta take me and my wife out of this apartment because you know I helped you while your father was off in jail for accidentally killing your wife. No, spoiler alert, but. That's sort of character that puts his own motivation.
Have you started lumping these characters together into neglectful parent, office boss? Victorian era person.
They definitely fit like about 8 or 9 different larger categories. Like the high school bully, the insensitive coach. There's a whole bunch like that.
I'm gonna actually suggest another one here too. I'm thinking of Reflections in a Golden Eye, the John Huston adaptation of the Carson McCullers novel. With Robert Forster as the object of affection to Marlon Brando. But in the sense of, there the villainy is kind of like twofold, in the sense that Robert Forster is a sort of poisonous object of desire to Marlon Brando, and so then Brando himself becomes the villain to himself. Like, so it's kind of like a symbiotic alien relationship, and alien parasitic relationship, I should say.
Maybe a shock comparison, like on Mulholland Drive,
Well, in a sense, exactly. Like you could say in some ways that Laura Lena Herring is the villain to Naomi Watts.
Right, exactly. And she would be more likely to late to make the list than Naomi
right,
Watts would.
But then Naomi Watts sort of becomes unsympathetic in a way, even though you still sort of sympathize with them, so it creates this kind of weird, conversation between things. It's kind of like a muddled villainy.
Exactly.
By the way, let me point out how weird it is that when Mulholland Drive came out, no one knew what the hell happened in it, and Roger Ebert even wrote a whole essay about how he shows it, like, in his, like, festival or whatever, and he shows it to students, and they went over it for 2 days, and now everyone's like, yeah, well then she puts out a hit on her, and then she feels guilty about that, so she masturbates.
It's about an actress who's dreaming, and then she wakes up, and she kills herself.
Whoa.
That's it.
In under 10 years, everyone's like, okay, now I know what
this is. Back when
about.
I first saw it, I was like, what just happened? I can't believe...
Roger Ebert officially said, I love this movie, and it's the only movie that I literally have no idea what happens in it.
Right,
and now
it seems like that, but I remember when Pitchfork published that,
I saw that Pitchfork, it was like someone very calmly and clearly said, this is exactly what happens in Mulholland.
Right, and it was like, oh, I guess that makes sense.
Unfortunately, I have to interject at this point with the
No More Stop Clock.
Speaking of movies that have no fucking sense whatsoever, Speed Racer.
Yes.
It will come out by the time you listen to this.
It's out by the time we're recording.
It's out today.
Yeah,
oh my!
I think today's
the
day.
What the fuck am I doing here? Bye.
Go Speed Racer.
John's
go.
Gone. Thank you.
So honestly, Vadim and I were having conversations about this a little while back on the internet, and we were wondering, why are the Wachowskis still entrusted with Blockbuster?
That's not what I said.
That's a good question.
No.
We get into the aspect of the Wachowskis are only good at one thing. High octane, intense action sequences.
Yes. So back in the day, when you had William Wyler make that piece of shit Ben Hur,
and excuse me, lesbian sex scenes.
Yeah.
Right, back in the day.
Which really weren't that good.
So back in the day, you would have a guy come in to film the chariot race, which is all anyone really likes about Ben-Hur anyway. And you get that guy, and he does the action sequences. And then William Wyler, you know.
I like the homoerotic tension between Charles Manson and Stephen Boyd.
Courtesy of Gore Vidal, but I mean, you know.
Amen to that. So, and Truman Capote in Beat the Devil, but go on. Anyway.
Truman Capote, who wrote The Innocents as a kind of coming out villainy story, apparently.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the Wachowski brothers should have been those guys. They should have been the guys who show up and they give you the kick-ass action sequence and they go away. But no, the Wachowski brothers really believe that having read Jean Baudrillard for about 20 minutes, that A, he's the most important thinker in Western civilization, and B, they've got something to say about it. And the level of their thinking is roughly on par with Steven Lisberger making Tron in 1982 and announcing to all and sundry that Tron is an exploration of Jungian archetypes and symbolism. Because if you've read the interviews, and I have,
I'm sure you have.
He says, you know, Tron has got the triangle and the arch and it's all Jung and you got to get into it. It's like, you can't change the fact that Tron kind of sucks, you know? Like,
But it is that, as the Wachowskis is an example of Baudrillard and everything, within this sort of corporatized structure, which makes for an interesting...
But they absolutely suck at it.
No,
but their conviction in themselves is fascinating.
So they suck at it in The Matrix, and I'm going to say right here that I think Speed Racer is a much more interesting movie than any of the Matrix movies.
Speed Racer
and probably their most accomplished
film. Speed Racer isn't a film anymore.
I'd also
Speed Racer is a computer. It's basically a CGI backdrop with Emil Hirsch going... Okay, how did he look in the cartoon? Okay, so he looks like so he does the thumbs up like this. Okay,
And Christina Ricci look like an actor.
Emil, don't worry, we can fix that with Photoshop.
No, I don't think it's like that at all. I think Emil Hirsch has been directed in a very specific way to be the sort of grounded center to this very crazy stuff going around him. And I've seen the movie, so I feel I know what I'm talking about.
Unlike the rest of us, who have not yet.
I feel I know what I'm talking about.
Let's argue anyway.
Is that Emil Hirsch is dressed in very sort of like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like downbeat, you know, like cool colors. Whereas everybody else is sort of bright, orange, purple, red. You
so
know,
he's
like,
intentionally...
He's intentionally like grounded in this kind of dark... You know, jeans and black t-shirt kind of look. Not really brooding, per se, but just, you know, if I say white noise, I don't mean it as a negative. I mean it in the sense of he's been directed as a sort of blank slate around which all these other things occur. And they've done a very interesting thing in the movie that I don't know if I can say any other racing movie has really done this. Whenever they do races in the car... When the people outside of the car, like in the audience and stuff, are of course doing the rah, screaming kind of thing. You're like, yeah, go, 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 and all that. In the car, they're talking like they're in a Bergman or a Bresson film. They're just like having these intimate either self-conversations or conversations with each other between their different vehicles as if they're in a removed sort of space. And there's this one scene that sticks out in particular to me where Speed and Trixie are having this conversation because they're both in two different cars. And the camera is essentially moving through digital help between Speed here and Trixie there and back and forth like that. So it's like moving, it's going from Speed and then zooming to Trixie, and then like moving to Trixie, going back to Speed, back and forth. And they're just talking as if they're having a normal conversation. And I think that's a very intentional aesthetic choice that actually adds this kind of...
It's an aesthetic choice, but at the same time, it's what the Wachowskis do. They have to pull you out visually constantly to make up for what is otherwise a lackluster plot.
But wait a minute now. Hold on. Plots,
I like that one.
Plot in certain cases does not matter. Plot is harped upon.
Speed Racer is the Jerry of blockbusters.
It might be. But, okay, wait. Plot is something that a lot of critics in the public eye harp on. And the thing is, they harp on it even when to the film in question, and I think we do have to assume, even with all the repetitions and all the things that we feel we've seen before, that each film is in some way unique. That basically... The plot in Speed Racer is not the point. It is incoherent in the sense that it allows the visuals. Where in a lot of the other Wachowski films, save for Bound, which I think actually does work visually, whereas the Matrix movies I don't think really do. There's some kind of disconnect there that just prevents them from working very well.
The fight on top of the moving truck in Matrix Reloaded is the single finest action sequence of the decade. It makes that whole movie worth watching.
I haven't
I can't agree.
It's a marvel definitely. Of choreography and editing in the last 15 minutes.
It goes on. Yeah, it goes on forever.
I cannot agree. I think there are things in Speed Racer that top that tremendously in every way.
I would be very skeptical.
See, I think that's true. And I think yes.
I want to think that you're right, and you may possibly be once I see it.
I don't expect anyone to agree with me. I expect people to vilify me for saying.
Well, because this movie has been so poorly reviewed, I expect to enjoy it quite a bit. I'm hoping it's the new Elizabethtown. So
honestly, I need to see that.
You know what? You know, I said this on Movie Geeks United. I said this on Movie Geeks United, which I was on the other day, and I'm going to say it again here, just because you know, and I'm sure it's stupid, and I'm going to preface this by. It's stupid in some ways, but I'm going to preface it also by saying that I mean it half jokingly and half seriously, but I think that for better or for worse, Speed Racer is this generation's 2001. Yes.
Wow, I hope that's true.
See, yes. I just
And Glenn Kenny got onto this vein where he said at the end of the final race in Speed Racer, he wouldn't have been surprised if the Star Child appeared. And that is what this movie gives. I'm not saying. Let me clarify. I'm not saying that this is in any way the equal 2001. The reason 2001 is great is because it is its own thing. Genius is anomalous. Genius cannot be replicated. It is something where lightning just strikes, and it is brilliant in and of itself, and it can never be replicated. And anyone who thinks it can, I think, is a fucking idiot.
See, but here's the problem.
Yes.
The genius that you say can't be replicated?
Yeah.
Well, pretty much anyone that Frank Miller did at first with the CGI backdrops in Sin City.
Oh my god, that's not genius that hackery disguised as,
well,
like,
then,
novelty.
What do we, well, then what do we call the Wachowskis then?
What do we call the Wachowskis? We call them people who got led astray by their idea because they graduated school, they know something.
And this is something I have to learn. We basically judge the Wachowskis movie by movie, as we should judge everybody movie by movie, because sometimes...
But they're moving farther and farther away from actually having... They just have flesh and bone actors stand in front of a green screen or in a prop car and go, now you're really fast. Oh my god, missile. Look at the ball. This is a missile. Look at the ball.
But, whereas in The Matrix, I think they're trying to use CG to extend certain things and do it kind of lazily. I think in Speed Racer, it's very much part of the aesthetic. And I'm going to say that one of the reasons that I think it is that it effectively obliterates, with some exceptions in the movie, shot reverse shot. Every time they can obliterate shot reverse shot, either by what I was describing with the conversation between Trixie and Speed, and or with a conversation, say, between, you know, the two corporate types in the movie, which is not shown shot reverse shot, but which is shown at first from the back, as if it's almost an Antonioni film in like the stock exchange, you know, in the police, you know, with the two people talking from behind. But then to have, like, their faces and their conversation sort of be the visual wipes. So, like, one of the people will suddenly have their face come into close-up as you're seeing them in long shot and wipe the long shot away as they'll suddenly sort of mimic, like, this kind of Janus effect of each head talking to each other, you know, away from each other, and then suddenly moving to wipe the screen so that they're against each other, and then still having the long shot in between. So it's a very sophisticated kind of dialectic that's going on in this movie that a lot of people are not acknowledging because they're treating it as a summer blockbuster.
See, but even Koverman said there is not one single cut in this film. Everything's either a wipe or it's a dissolve.
Yeah. And that's in the context of this movie, that's interesting. Now another movie that's coming out right now that I haven't seen yet, but a lot of people have praised, and I don't know if you've seen it, Vadim, is the Tracy Fragments.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm so excited about that.
Which Dan Salit, who is one of the great like online cinephiles, has praised to no end and said that it effectively reinvents cinema. And it, from what he's saying that it does with all its different fragmented kind of imagery in the movie, I mean, it sounds in a sense like the experience that I got from Speed Racer.
For those who don't know, the Tracy Fragments is a movie that's entirely in split screens, sometimes multiple split screens, thereby realizing Brian De Palma's wet dream of many years.
Time code, man.
Yeah. And it stars Ellen, Juno, lesbian Paige.
Hey, you take that back. She's not lesbian yet.
Okay, Ellen.
She will be by the time
Ellen, pedophile murderer Paige. Ellen Hard Candy Paige.
Is she the guy in that movie?
Hard Candy, have you seen it?
I don't know, she actually killed a guy in that movie?
No, but,
I can't spoil that.
Sort of.
I had a plot-related question based on Speed Racer.
Yeah.
Because you referred to him as Speed.
Yeah.
Is Speed Racer his actual full name?
Yes.
So his dad would be like, you know, Dan Racer?
Yeah. No, he's Pop Racer.
Pop Racer. Okay.
Pop Racer, Mom Racer, Rex Racer, you know, it's his brother.
And but like in elementary school, he would be seated under R for Racer.
Yes.
Okay.
And there is a teacher in the movie who goes, Speed Racer, slow down!
Life must have sucked for Pop growing up.
Yeah.
Pop, get in here.
But no, I really like Speed Racer. I mean, I saw it with Aaron Hillis, and you know, he and I were talking about sort of the Lynchian Rorschach aspects of it afterwards, like sort of the Inland Empire kind of revelation of the Wachowski psyche. And it does have some of that weird Wachowski transsexualism that has become more and more prominent as the one brother has sort of made his transition.
They actually have to wait until a future podcast once we've all seen it. So
I really want to see this.
Sit down and do it.
All right, no Murray stop clock. But
no Murray stop clock. What's left?
I think that's a good point to
end tonight. Once again, we'd like to thank everyone for listening.
We know you're not listening at this point, so.
Yes, you are.
Someone is. Right, Mom? Right? Actually, no.
Mom, I hope you're not listening. My God.
In the house next door, I'm John Lichtman, joined as always by Vadim Rizov and Keith Ulick, and special guest Andrew Unterberger. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, guys.
This is Lichtman Rizov, live in Irkutsk Express Tavern, episode 10. As seen on VH1.
Good
night.
Good night. Woo!